Well, as mentioned, I am the youth coordinator here at TAC, and I'm in my fourth year of being a youth leader. Prior to that, I led worship here for about a year and a half. And usually, if I'm involved in a Sunday morning service, I'm actually hiding back there. That is, behind the drums and not the curtains, because that would be kind of weird now, wouldn't it? Peekaboo, hey. So this is a whole new experience for me. I've been up here before, but I haven't done this before. I get to kind of stand in Steve's shoes for a few minutes. Hopefully it's not too many minutes for your sake. But hopefully this is a good time for all of us as we hang out together. Before my time in ministry, I spent a majority of my time working in the restaurant industry, actually. And I also pursued a career in music. And for about 10 years, I actually worked at White Spot just down the road here. I was a cook, and it wasn't a bad place to work, not bad at all. The people were really nice, and the flexibility allowed me the opportunity to pursue other interests. I could focus on music and still maintain my employment. It was a pretty good deal. But over time, as I worked there, I received more responsibility. And as I did, it seemed that my level of enjoyment at work started to decrease. The more responsibility I had, the less I liked my job. And for the longest time, I thought it was just the stress, because restaurants are busy, and I thought it was just the stress and the busyness, and I, you know, I just chalked it up to being that. But a few years ago, I learned something about myself, and it helped me to understand why I felt that way. And this is it. I have control issues. It's true. Don't be shocked. I have control issues. It's true. The way I'm wired is I like to know who's in charge. I like to know what I can control. I kind of need to know how things will run. And the problem is at White Spot at that time, the way it operated, it wasn't always clear who was in control. The guidelines and the systems didn't always help if you were the one who was in control. And it wasn't clear, and as a result, I found myself stressed and frustrated, and I was really grumpy. Like, at times you did not want to see me. My wife can, she worked there at the same time, she can probably attest to that. It was not a good sight at times. And on top of that, when you work in a kitchen, you work with these other cooks, and you're supposed to be this team. You're supposed to be on the same page. And often, despite my best efforts, if I was leading the crew, there would always be at least one who wasn't on the same page. And I would try so hard, you know, to motivate, to direct, to fire them up so that they would move faster, so that we could get the job done. And despite my best efforts, I couldn't get some of these guys going. And I'd have my food ready, and it'd be like, you know, triple O burger, French fries, now! And it's like, now! I need fries, and raise my voice. I would dance and try to get their attention. And some of these people, they had one gear, and it was ultra slow, and there was nothing you could do to motivate them to actually move faster. There's nothing you could do to get them to accomplish what you wanted. And I'd be resigned to frustration because I'd have very little ability to control the situation beyond my own actions. And if we're all honest, I think we'll admit that we all like to be in control. I think that we find a certain sense of security in knowing what we have control over, in controlling certain areas of our lives. We like to dictate how things will work. We like to prevent things from getting in our way. We don't like it when obstacles prevent us from having our will. For instance, maybe you found yourself driving down the road. You're in a 50 zone, and there's somebody in front of you, and they're doing 20. And you find yourself frustrated because you've got somewhere to be. You know, you've got a destination, you've got an appointment, and there's somebody, bless their hearts, who doesn't seem to know where the gas pedal is. You know, that or it's Sunday afternoon, I'm not sure, but there's somebody who's in your way and they won't move. And you have no ability to control them, to change the situation. You're resigned to just be stuck behind them. And it's frustrating. But that's what life is like. There are things we like to be in control of: knowledge, finances, our resources, relationships, health, work, grades, our kids. Yeah, it's true. Parents, we like to be in control of you guys. It's comforting for us. But often circumstances, it reminds us that we don't have as much control as we'd like. That some things are beyond our ability to govern. And at the heart of this thought is that if we can control it, we're going to be secure. That if we can dictate our circumstances, there's safety. We like to be in control because in this we find assurance. But what happens when we lose control? What happens when the circumstances of life, when it robs us of our ability to govern our situation or to be in control of what we possess? What happens then? What happens when the things that we find security in fail us? In life, there's going to be times when we are reminded of this, that so much is beyond our control. I guarantee it. There's going to be times, maybe small times, maybe huge times. And as much as we hate to admit it, we are going to discover that we have an inability to guarantee our security and to control everything. Now today we're back in the Gospel of Luke after our Easter weekend, last weekend. We're back in the Gospel of Luke and we're hoping to hear from God on this subject as we engage in a couple of stories about Jesus. And we're in Luke chapter 8. It's 865 in the Pew Bible. And I'm going to start by reading the first section, which is 22 through 25. Luke chapter 8, 22 through 25. Jesus calms a storm. One day he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, "Let's go across to the other side of the lake." And so they set out, and they sailed, and he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he awoke, and he rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased. And there was a calm. And he said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the waters, and they obey him?" So Jesus and his disciples, they've been traveling around the region of Galilee. It's northern Israel. Jesus has been teaching. He's been healing the sick. He's been restoring sight to the blind. He's been delivering people from demons. And he's even raised a young man from the dead. And as we come to this point in the story, Jesus has been teaching and ministering all day long. And as evening comes, he directs his disciples to take him across the lake, across the Sea of Galilee. And it's quite likely that this was motivated by a need for rest, that Jesus was exhausted, that he needed to get away from the crowds. This was a place that throughout Jesus' ministry, we see him at least a few times going across this lake to find some solitude. So that's probably what's happening at this point. And as they set out on the water, we find that Jesus has fallen asleep. And the disciples are left to navigate the journey. Now we pause for a moment here because we needed to be reminded of who these disciples are. Because I think it gives a little bit of significance to this story. At least seven of these disciples, they were fishermen from this area. They spent much of their time sailing and fishing these waters. And this was familiar territory for them. It was kind of like their home turf. It was their comfort zone. See, they had left their boats, they had left their lifestyles, they had left everything to follow Jesus. And this may have been the first time where they actually returned to these waters since they had started following Jesus. It was the first time that they returned to the place that provided their livelihood, the place that was a security for them, a place that gave them their sense of identity. They were fishermen, and this was their home. Actually, later in the Gospels, we see that these disciples, after the death of Jesus, they're distraught, they're confused, they're unsure of what to make of all that has gone on. And where do we find them? Right back here, on these waters, doing what? Fishing. This was their comfort zone. It was a place that they had a sense of security. It's what they were familiar with. It must have been a place where they felt comfortable and in control. And another thing I think about the disciples, I'm guessing that in this moment they probably felt a certain sense of importance too. Because, you know, while their master slept, while Jesus slept, they were in control. They were the captain of the ship. It probably felt pretty good to them. And I say this because if you look at the life of the disciples, you actually see throughout the time of Jesus' ministry that they were often jockeying for position of importance. They were often seeking significance. This was kind of their MO. They often had debates about who was going to be the greatest, who was going to be the second in command next to Jesus. And I'm guessing that as Jesus slept, they're like, yeah, you know what, Jesus, take it easy. Yeah, you sleep because, well, this is what we know. You know the healing and you know all that stuff. This is what we know. So, yeah, put your head down, have a little nap. We're in control. But something happens. Suddenly it says that a storm, completely unexpectedly, a storm hits this lake. And Luke's language depicts it as a hurricane of wind. And Matthew uses the word seismos, which literally means earthquake, to depict these waters which are rolling and tossing and turning, to depict this chaos on the water. As this happens, the boat gets tossed about, and there are these mammoth waves that are shaking the boat and tossing it around. It's getting filled with waters. And it says, despite the disciples' best efforts, despite the bailing and the rowing, it says the situation was hopeless. And they said, we're going to die. We're going to die. See, the realization hits them that they were completely out of control, that they had no ability to change their circumstances. It hits them that they couldn't save themselves. And the amazing thing is that in the midst of all of this, Jesus sleeps. He's not stirred by the wind. He's not stirred by the waves. In this moment, we see this picture of Jesus completely at peace, not threatened by destructive forces, not threatened by the storm, not stirred. He wasn't threatened by these forces that were sure to destroy the vessel and crew. And so the disciples, finally, they call out to Jesus. They say, Master, Master, we are perishing. In Mark, it says, Teacher, don't you care that we are perishing? Jesus, how can you sleep at a time like this? Are you kidding me? They cry out, Jesus, save us! And Jesus wakes. He gets up and he speaks. And he says, Peace, be still. Peace, be still. And in a moment, in a split second, the wind, the water, it goes from complete, utter chaos to serenity, to absolute serenity. It goes from these circumstances of despair and hopelessness to peace and security. By the words of his mouth, he redeems his disciples from the threat of this storm and from their certain demise. And all is calm. It's incredible. It's amazing. And the disciples, they witness this and they're in shock. This is unbelievable. And then Jesus turns to them and he directs this question. Where is your faith? Gentlemen, where is your faith? Where are you placing your faith? Why do you have such little faith in me? Jesus says. And I think this is a loaded question that has a couple of implications. I think first of all, Jesus is saying that they had very little faith in him. In fact, that they didn't know who was in the boat with him. They had no idea who this was. Jesus had raised the dead. He'd healed the sick. People who were blind could see again. The dead were raised, and they were still left wondering, who is this man? They weren't getting it. And second, I think this question implies that the disciples were placing their faith in other things. It wasn't that they had no faith. It was that their faith was in other things, in a boat, in oars, in experience, in knowledge, in their ability, in their strength, in just about everything but the one who was in the boat with them. It wasn't in Jesus. And for the disciples and for us, there's this all-important message, a reminder for us at this point, that what we put our faith in matters. The object of our faith is critical. You can have all the faith in the world. All the faith in the world. If it's in something untrue and unreliable, it's useless. It'll be of no benefit to you, and it won't provide security. Jesus uses these extreme circumstances to teach his disciples and ultimately us as well the important message that he is in control, that he can be trusted. He's teaching them to put their faith in the one who won't fail them. In this moment, Jesus is declaring something amazing. He's declaring his sovereignty. He's declaring his authority, his power, his dominion over waves, over wind, over storm. And more than that, Jesus is saying, I'm sovereign over all of it. I'm sovereign over creation. Don't miss it. I'm sovereign over all of it. Trees, animals, sun, moon, stars, sky. Jesus is in control, and he can be trusted. The disciples, they're dumbfounded. They're in awe. They're amazed. They're afraid, and which is great on many levels because there's a response. And I think the problem is that we hear this, and there's very little response. Like we've heard this message time and time again since we were probably in Sunday school. Yeah, God is sovereign. He's in control. He's almighty. And we're left unmoved. Oh, God forgive us. This is one of the most amazing things to know that the one who's in the boat is in control. The one who's in the boat, he's sovereign. Our faith in him and we're safe. This is unbelievable news. And yet, we kind of lose the significance. I do. Admit it. It's just old news. In this moment, Jesus is declaring that he is sovereign. Sovereign means in control, in authority, above. Sovereign over it all. And this is good news for us. And I hope that maybe this puts the wind, the waves, into perspective. It puts our lives into perspective. Our circumstances, our struggles, our hopes, our dreams, our security, our anxiety, our fear. I hope this puts that in perspective. The one who is in control is in the boat. Say this with me. He's in the boat. He's in the boat. Once more. He's in the boat. It's amazing. But the story continues, and we're going to look at verses 26 through 39. Verse 26. It says, so they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Steve probably could, but it sounds like a sneeze to me. Which is opposite Galilee. And when Jesus had stepped out on the land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. And for a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out, and he fell down before him, and he said with a loud voice, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. And Jesus asked him, what is your name? And he said, Legion. For many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. And now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him to let them enter these. And so he gave them permission. And then the demons came out of the man, entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. And when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and they told it in the city and in the country, and the people went out to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and they found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at Jesus' feet, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country and the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and he returned. And the man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for them. Now they arrive on the east side of the lake. It's a largely non-Jewish area, and it says that there was this great welcoming committee. They were greeted by this orchestra, and there was a large crowd of people. There were women that were placing flowers around their neck. There were people doing the wave. It was this amazing scene on the other side. No, that's not what happened at all, right? I bet you that's what the disciples were hoping for after their ordeal. No, instead they get something from a horror movie. They've just arrived at Elm Street. It's Freddy Krueger. It's the spawn of Satan. It's this man violently running at them and confronting them. And I can imagine the disciples at this point seeing this and just going, "Yo, Jesus, let's take our chances out here on the water. I think we have better odds out here. You know, we didn't really sign up for this. This is just too weird. Jesus, come on." But as they look, they see Jesus standing toe-to-toe with this man possessed. He's standing up to him. This man who, possessed by evil spirits, he's been driven to isolation. He's naked, he's violent, he's insane, he's tormented, and death has become his home. And there's Jesus standing with him. For some of you, at this point of the story, you're saying, "Okay, demon possession, is this real? Are you kidding me? Is this really what's going on? Like, demons, they're real, and people can be possessed by them? Is that what's happening here?" Maybe the gospel writers, they didn't understand mental illness, so they used this as a way to, you know, just describe what was going on, but that's not really what was happening. You know, maybe they just didn't understand it, so they called it demon possession. But surely that's not what's going on here. But everything we see in this text, everything we see throughout the Bible, tells us that demons are real, that possession is real, that this is really happening. Everything throughout the Bible. The Bible teaches us that demons, they were once angels. They were once servants of the Most High God. And there was a chief angel. His name was Lucifer. And he was glorious. And pride welled up in this angel's heart. And he wanted what God had. He saw God's throne. He saw worship. He said, "That's mine." So he started a rebellion. It says that he took a third of the angels, he led them astray, and they fought against God, trying to take God from his throne. But God and his army of angels, they defeated them. They cast them out of heaven, and these demons remained. Many of them remained in a completely cursed, wicked, depraved state. And they have one thing on their heart and mind: to oppose God and to destroy God's work. They just want to completely oppose God's will. And Jesus encounters a man who's possessed by these things, who's being controlled by evil spirits. The story tells us that it's not just one demon that invaded this man. It says that his name was Legion. because there was many of them. And we don't know for sure how many there are, but we can speculate that it was probably thousands. See, there were, in the other Gospels, it tells us there were 2,000 pigs in the story. Or if we compare it to a Roman legion of soldiers, there were 6,000. So we don't know for sure how many, but there were a ton of them. Probably thousands of these demons that were tormenting this man. And Jesus confronts these foul creatures. And it's interesting because these creatures know who he is. They recognize his power and authority over him. And Jesus speaks to these demons, and it says that they have no other recourse but to obey him. And then we see this amazing thing that as he speaks, as these demons flee, we see the impact of Jesus on a man's life. This man is restored. He's taken from darkness and brought into light. He's removed from isolation and abandonment, and he's received into relationship and community. He's delivered from the graveyard into new life. And in this encounter, the amazing thing is we see a vivid picture. This is God's redeeming work in real life. It's amazing. God's redeeming work. It's what we celebrated last week. It's the history of redemption in the life of a man who's possessed. It's a beautiful picture of a man being saved from sin and death and being given life through Jesus. It's awesome. We see how Jesus dealt with the spiritual issue in this man. Now, in contrast, it's interesting to see that the people of that region, they responded to this issue of the demon-possessed man in a slightly different way. See, they responded to a spiritual issue with physical tools. They sought to control him with shackles and with chains. They were trying to suppress what is unseen, these spiritual forces, with things that are seen. And it says that it was futile. As much as they tried, since this man broke the chains, and there was nothing they could do to hold him. But Jesus demonstrates that by his power and authority, in an act of deliverance, he says that what you can't control with your best efforts, I can. He declares that in this moment that he's not only sovereign over nature and the things that we see, but Jesus is sovereign over everything that we don't see. Even these powerful beings, even a multitude of them, thousands must flee at the word of Jesus. That's awesome. But now here's where the story gets a little weird. That is, if naked guy in the graveyard isn't weird enough. In a conversation between Jesus and these demons, we see that the demons are afraid, and they beg Jesus not to torment them, not to send them into this abyss, which we understand to be like a spiritual prison for these spirits. But instead, the demons beg Jesus to allow them to go into this herd of pigs, which in their minds is a much better fate. I don't know. And Jesus grants the demons their request, and they leave the man, and they enter in, and they possess this herd of swine, and subsequently they rush down this hill and they crash into the lake and they drown. And in this moment, there's a question that comes out. Why pigs? This is really weird. Is there a significance to this? Are we supposed to gain some sort of understanding from this incident? You know, the text actually doesn't seem all that clear, and it gives all kinds of speculation. Some would say that it was simply for God's glory, maybe. Others say that it was to give evidence that the demons were real. Some say perhaps it was the demons entered the pigs. The pigs were surprised, so they trampled down the hill, and then God in turn used this as a vehicle of judgment on these evil spirits. Maybe. Some say, well, the pigs, they, in the Jewish culture, they represented uncleanness, so we see that the spirits are actually unclean. I think the guy actually, it was clear enough from Naked Guy in the Tombs that these spirits were bad news. I think there's actually only one thing that we can be sure of. Some of these things may be possible, but one thing we can be sure of from the story of the pigs. See, these wicked, sinful creatures, they knew what they deserved. They knew what awaited them. They had great anguish about this destination of torment, and they cried out for mercy. They begged and pleaded that Jesus wouldn't send them there, that he would show them mercy, that he wouldn't punish them in this spiritual prison that awaited them. And Jesus, in this moment, in maybe the most amazing part of this story, he does the unexpected. And he didn't give them what they deserve. Jesus showed them mercy. Unbelievable. Jesus showed them mercy. And ultimately, in these two stories, Jesus shows all of us the very nature of God, who is all-powerful, all-knowing, over everything, infinite, the in-control God who is merciful. Unbelievable. Now, in contrast, we see the nature of demons and wickedness and sin on display through their influence in the man and their influence in the pigs. And regardless of what they've seen, regardless of what these creatures knew, regardless of the mercy that they received, their very nature is destruction. Their path leads them to death. We see these demons, we see sin, we see wickedness for exactly what it is. Exactly what it is. It's that which opposes God's will, tries to steal God's glory, fights against God's work. And the scary thing is that it's not all that different for us. Because of sin, we're in a similar place. And sin says, "You are not God, I am." Sin says, God, you can't be trusted, so I'm going to be in control. And we're polite Canadians, so we're not really quite that bold. But we do it in much more subtle ways. We say, Jesus, just take a back seat because I got this one. You know what? I can handle it. It's more subtle, but the message is the same. God, you can't be trusted in this instant. So I'm going to hold on to everything. Because of our rebellion against God, because of our sin, in much the same way, our nature leads us to death and destruction. But because of God's mercy, because of Jesus, because of the death he died for us, because of his victory over the grave, we can be set free. We can be delivered from that graveyard and be brought back into life. Given a new nature, delivered from nakedness and shame, being clothed, whole, forgiven, renewed, if only we place our faith in the one who is sovereign, the one who is in control. If we place our faith in the one who is in the boat with us, we can be set free. We don't have to be on that path that leads to drowning and destruction, the path that leads to the lake. We can be renewed and forgiven. If we place our faith in Jesus. So where is our faith? What gives us security? What are we placing our hope in? What is it? When the waves hit, when the earth shakes, when the stock market crashes, when a relationship is broken, when someone betrays you, when the doctor calls and the news isn't good, where are you going to turn? What are you going to trust in? Now, it's likely that each one of us here is going to identify with some part in this story. And I see four main ways that we can identify. I think for some of us, maybe a few of us, I don't know, maybe you're like the townspeople who heard of Jesus. They kind of saw what Jesus did. They saw the effects of Jesus with pigs and this man. And they're like, wow, no thank you. And they want to hold Jesus at arm's length. They don't want Jesus to disrupt their nice and ordered lives. And so they just say, no, thank you. Maybe that's you today. If that's you today, I want to challenge you with this question. Who is this man? I want to challenge you to wrestle with that question. Because here's the thing. Whether you like it or not, you're going to answer that question one day, if that's you. And guess what? Every one of us, one day, is going to have to answer that question. Who is that man? The Bible says that every knee will bow, every tongue will confess. Everyone is going to answer that question. If you're holding Jesus at arm's length, it's better now than later, trust me. Wrestle with that question. I guarantee you're going to discover that Jesus is who he said he is and that he's trustworthy and true. Many here, I don't know, maybe a few here, maybe you're like, oh, I'm in the boat with Jesus, but the waves are crashing. And maybe for some of you, you just need to be reminded that Jesus is in control. And that's just comfort and security. That's awesome. But maybe you're going like, yeah, I'm in the boat with Jesus, but I'm not feeling it. Is it possible that you're still hanging on to the oars? Is it possible that maybe you're creating the waves because you're holding on to something and Jesus is saying, just let go, let go, let go? Maybe that's you today. Trust in the one who's in the boat. Let go and let him speak to the storm. He might not take you out of the storm, but he'll guide you through it. Maybe, I think most of us, maybe you are the one who's sitting at the feet of Jesus. You're sitting there, and you've been redeemed, you've been renewed, and that is great news. It's probably most of us here. And you're sitting there, and you've been given new clothes, and this is good. But I think the problem for all of us, myself, big time, is that we fail to miss what comes next. Because it wasn't enough for the man to just sit there. It wasn't enough. Jesus said, now go. Go and tell the people what God has done for you. And I think that for us, the big challenge for a lot of us is that now we've got to go out there to the people who are in the tombs, who are hurting, who are broken, and share this good news of the one who has set us free. Let's respond in awe. Lord God, stir up awe and amazement at the one who is sovereign. Stir that up in our hearts so that we would go out and go, guess what? Best news, Jesus is in the boat. Oh, I pray that God would do that work in us even today, and that this week we would have the courage by God's strength to share that good news. Wherever we are in the story, God is there to meet us and bring us out of the darkness and into the light. From hopelessness to hope, from alienation and abandonment to love, from that into relationship and community, from bondage to freedom, from chaos to order, from death to life. God is there to do that work in us. And may we place our faith in the one who will do that work, in the one who is sovereign over all that we see and all that is unseen. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for the reminder that you are in control and we are not, that you are God and we are most certainly not. And I pray that today you would stir up a response in our hearts to this truth so that we would be changed. Lord, in whatever way we need to respond, I pray that you would give us the strength to do that. May you be honored, may you be glorified, and may you help us to just let go where we need to. We give you thanks, and we pray this in Jesus' name.